From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
It's a phenomenon known as déjà vu. You arrive at a place you've never been, but it feels familiar.
Do you ever have déjà vu, Mrs. Lancaster?
I don't think so, but I could check with the kitchen. There is something so familiar about this.
Hmm?
Do you ever have déjà vu?
Didn't you just ask me that?
Déjà vu. If you think it's just a feeling, go back and look again.
Chris Moulin is a cognitive neuropsychologist at England's Leeds University. Memory is one of his main research interests, especially that trick of memory we call déjà vu. Moulin told Anne Strangechamps how he became interested in the phenomenon.
I first got interested in déjà vu as a result of a patient who came to see me whilst I was working in a memory clinic, and he had a very unusual presentation in that his wife said he was having constant déjà vu and he was repeating things and he felt everything was repeating. And that's quite a strange memory error, so naturally I kind of paid attention to him. The problem was when his GP said he ought to come and see the memory specialist, he said he'd already been before, and that was really the start of his problems.
Wow, so he had never seen you before, but he thought he had?
Right, exactly. So it turned out that was a pattern that was confirmed with many other things, but almost anything that was really novel and really striking and maybe only happened once in his life, he felt that that was something that he'd already done before.
So how did that play out in his everyday life?
Well, the main thing that you'd notice is that him and other cases like him is that they sort of appear a bit kind of depressed in that they seem withdrawn and not interested in things that are going on. So they'll stop watching television because they feel that everything's been on before, or they won't read the newspaper because they feel they already know the news events. If you think about your daily life and what's interesting to you, it's the novel things that help you get through each day. If you're just doing the same thing over and over again, you'd soon kind of get a bit, you know, dejected and find less interest in the world.
Did you ever see the movie Groundhog Day?
Yeah, so in fact, I didn't see Groundhog Day until after I'd started working with this patient. In some ways, I regret that because we've used the phrase déjà vu and déjà vécu to describe these cases, but I think Groundhog Day would have summed it up a lot better, in fact. It's a lot closer to Groundhog Day than it is the sorts of déjà vu experiences that we get.
That's the movie in which Bill Murray keeps repeating, he keeps reliving Groundhog Day over and over and over again, and he gradually becomes unhinged, I mean, deeply depressed, and
yep. You know,
because it's as though he's caught in this horrible time warp that he can't ever break out of.
Rita, I'm reliving the same day over and over. Groundhog Day, today.
Okay, I'm waiting for the punchline.
No, really, this is the third time. It's like yesterday never happened.
I am racking my brain, but I can't even begin to imagine why you'd make up something like this.
I'm not making it up. I am asking you for help.
Okay, what do you want me to do?
I don't know. You're a producer. Come up with something.
That's really how it feels for your patients? That's terrible.
Yeah, I would imagine it's probably not as extreme as that. I know Bill Murray tries to kill himself and he can't because he just, you know, continues to exist. Of course, there's nothing kind of metaphysical or magical with these people's lives, but there is certainly that extent that they just feel that they've been there, done that, and therefore they're not so interested in engaging in what happens.
You've coined a new phrase for this experience, not just déjà vu, but déjà vécu. What do you mean by that?
In fact, we didn't quite coin the term déjà vécu, so it was in use before, but we tried to make the term more technical to apply to these very strong instances of déjà vu. So basically the idea is that déjà vécu is a very strong, pervasive form of déjà vu. And the idea is that we know in human memory that there's two forms of memory. One is a weaker sense of familiarity and the other is a strong evocative sense of remembering. And we thought that déjà vu was an instance where you have a false sensation of familiarity, this weak sense, but then a stronger version of it would be called déjà vécu.
Which means?
Which means already lived before. So all these déjà states, they all have various names from French past participles. So it wasn't us that first used the term déjà vécu, it was Arthur Funkhauser, and he used it. But before him, people were trying to classify déjà vu just by using different sorts of past participles. So déjà entendu for already heard, déjà visité for already visited, and so on.
How common a phenomenon is this, do you think?
This phenomenon with my patients is rare, but in fact it's probably more common than we think. So every time I appear on the radio talking about these sorts of things, maybe another one or two cases which are exactly the same come out. That's kind of reassuring for us because it suggests we've found something that's kind of tangible and a bona fide memory error. But also for the people who suffer from this and their carers, I think that's also very reassuring because they find that they're not alone and that there is some idea of why this is happening and who it happens to. But that said, I mean, it's very, very rare. I think we're probably now up to about 20 to 30 cases worldwide. Mm.
Do you think this is a new disease that's just now appearing, or do you think it's something that doctors have just never really noticed before or that patients have kept quiet about?
I think that this is probably something that's been going on for a long time. And I think there's two things, really. I think in the state of the art with psychology, we're becoming much better at asking people about their subjective experience and classifying that. And then on the other hand, I think there's also a change in people's willingness to talk about their mental states. So I think it used to be very taboo to talk about these sorts of errors, and people didn't want to share these experiences because they were worried that people would think they were going mad. But now I think that people are not so worried about those sorts of things. So I think we're meeting in the middle. The scientists, psychologists and medics are understanding these conditions better, but also people are more willing to talk about them.
So what do you think is going on with your patients? What's causing this kind of very persistent form of déjà vu?
I think cases like this have been around for quite a long time, but only in instances where there's definite brain damage. So the first case seems to be reported in 1876, and this was somebody who went to quite amazing things like Pasteur's funeral. He was a French case. He went to Louis Pasteur's funeral and he claimed he'd already been there before, and it was a state funeral. And so it was a rather striking event, and yet he claimed he'd been there before. But he, like my patients, had damage to a particular area of the brain, which was the temporal lobes. And this is a part of the brain very, very important for everyday memory and the sensations of remembering and all those rich evocative images and things that are generated when you have a memory. This is the area of the brain responsible for that.
What is it that's gone wrong? When we have the ordinary kind of déjà vu that most of us are familiar with, just a very brief, fleeting sensation that, oh, you know, maybe I've been here before. I think I saw that woman in the street once before, didn't I? What do you think is going on in that area of the temporal lobes?
I think that's the million-dollar question, really, the relationship between maybe what happens in a healthy brain and what happens in a damaged brain. The only evidence we have at the moment is that it's the same kind of area. But if you think of the brain as a very complex kind of electrical map, it's more or less usually firing in a certain way over time. So certain parts of the brain are turning on and they're communicating with other parts of the brain, and there's a rich, complex network. So with major damage, you might see quite major sorts of disruption, and that would be the sorts of disruption we get in my patients. But with a kind of a more minor glitch and maybe a temporary time where everything fires at once rather than doing it in an interconnected way, then that's where we might have the kind of the healthy experience of déjà vu.
So how have you gone about researching this phenomenon?
The difficulty with déjà vu is once you've had these striking patients, is to then try and really reproduce some of those experiences in the laboratory. And this is always the kind of acid test in psychology. If you think you know what is the cause of something, you should be able to reproduce it. You should be able to simulate it.
But that means you have to get somebody to have déjà vu in the laboratory while you're scanning their brain.
Yeah, or you have to, you know, devise a clever series of questions which gets somebody to experience déjà vu. And all of these things have turned out to be easier said than done, but they're not complete failures. So we have had definite success using hypnosis, for instance. Now, the difficulty with hypnosis is that in itself, hypnosis isn't a mainstream tool in psychology. It's certainly a credible scientific tool and you can publish research on it. But not every memory researcher knows anything about hypnosis, so it's been quite difficult work to pursue.
But so how would you use hypnosis? Sort of make somebody have an experience and then tell them they've forgotten it?
The idea with producing deja vu is if we go back to this idea that it's a divorce between two normally simultaneous processes, you have to try and produce what's called a dissociation between those two streams. So you're right, you can give somebody the sensation that they're remembering when in fact they're not remembering, or you can give them some material that they will remember later but tell them that in fact they've forgotten it. And both of these methods...
I'm sorry, this sounds so twisted.
Well, obviously it has full ethical approval and it actually builds on methods that have been around sort of 50 years or so. But the idea is that for very mundane material, we give people lists of words and things like that, or ask them to solve a puzzle. But in some way, we fiddle with the relationship between whether they've actually encountered the information before and if they feel they've encountered it before. So basically, you're creating that disharmony between the two systems by using the power of suggestion, just simple hypnotic suggestion.
Does deja vu occur more often in some people than in others?
Yeah, so the figures are anything between 60 and 80% of the population have had at least one instance of deja vu. But there are some studies which say it correlates with other things. So happily, it correlates with intelligence, so that the more intelligent you are, the more often you seem to get it. But you also get it more if you travel more often, and that could be related to intelligence. And also to youth, so younger people seem to get it more.
Really?
Mm.
Why do you think that would be the case?
Well, that is peculiar, because if I'm saying it's a memory error, what we know about as you get older is your memory definitely gets worse. So you'd expect that if it was a memory failure, then you should be getting it more as you get older. So the aging question is the big one. So we've started doing some research on that, because it does seem like a paradox. And in fact, people have gone on record as saying that they think that deja vu increases as you get older, whereas all the evidence is that it does decrease. Because one problem might be is that you forget about it. So you have deja vu, but you forget you've had deja vu.
So in fact, perhaps older people are having it just as much,
yeah,
if not more,
so.
We just remember.
Yeah. And maybe you just get more used to these kind of little illusions, become more mundane as you get older.
What do you hope will come out of your research?
The main aim behind this research is that along the way we hope to illuminate individual cases and help them understand their difficulties and hopefully help them. But the big aim is not around individuals and people who suffer from deja vu. I think we're hoping to use deja vu to better understand human memory in general. So to use this as a little window into how the mind operates, and then from that we would hope to understand all sorts of situations where you might have dysfunctional memory sensations and memory problems which aren't just deja vu.
Chris Mullen is a cognitive neuropsychologist at Leeds University. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps. You can find a link to his blog on our website at ttbook.org. If you ever experienced deja vu, you can tell us about it by sending us an email through our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, Nietzsche's theory of eternal recurrence and watching Vertigo over and over again as we continue to explore deja vu. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Some demon were to say to you that this life, as you now live it and have lived it in the past, you would have to live once more, but innumerable times more. There would be nothing new in it. Every pain, every joy, every unutterably small or great thing in your life would just return to you. The same succession, same sequence, again and again, like an hourglass of time. Imagine infinity. Consider the possibility that every action you choose, Yosef, you choose for all time. Then all unlived life would remain inside you. Unlived throughout eternity.
That's a clip from the 2007 film When Nietzsche Wept, in which the characters talk about the concept of eternal recurrence. The concept is the subject of a book called Nietzsche's Life Sentence, Coming to Terms with Eternal Recurrence. Lawrence Atab is the author of the book. He's also a philosophy professor at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. Atab told Steve Paulson how Nietzsche introduces the concept of eternal recurrence in Thus Spoke Zarathustra.
Well, it's a story that he tells about this figure, Zarathustra, and he represents Nietzsche's life affirmation philosophy. He's a character who comes from isolation down from the mountain to speak with human beings about his insights. And the basic theme of it is to love the earth and to love earthly existence and to reject otherworldly doctrines and religions and things that look elsewhere for meaning in life. And yet he doesn't have a full set of beliefs to establish. He himself has to go through the confrontation with this idea of what would it mean to affirm life truly in all of its aspects. And this notion of eternal recurrence occurs in the text as the teaching that would most test Zarathustra's and anyone's ability to say yes to life. The idea that if life returns in exactly the same way, infinitely returning the same facts of life over and over again, so a cycle just runs its course and then repeats itself, this teaching becomes a kind of test for your capacity to say yes to life. And I think that Nietzsche meant that, well, if you found the idea of the eternal repetition of your life with no resolution, with no change over into something better, that this would be a real test of how you could accommodate life. And Zarathustra goes through this very same struggle because he realizes that, well, if everything comes back in the exact same way, then all the people and the beliefs that he hates, you know, the beliefs that are against life, the beliefs that are looking for another life, they come back too. And so he has to face the struggle of even wanting, being able to affirm the fact that the small man and the doctrines that he hates come back as well. So the idea is a fascinating one because what it poses is that, well, what would you say about life if you knew that all you were going to do is live it over again and again identically?
Right. It sounds sort of profoundly depressing, especially because you have to go back to all the bad stuff that has happened, and somehow you have to find meaning and, I suppose, even joy in that.
Well, that's the proposal in the text, and I think Nietzsche is very, not only is that a profound idea, but the story is profound because he doesn't simply say, well, this is the way it is, what do you think? He tells the story of this character, Zarathustra, who has to confront it in a deep way and experiences nausea at the idea that everything that he works against would have to come back as well. Because typically people would like to think that life in one way or another would work out things and overcome things that one hates or what one opposes. But that's the power of the idea. Could you say yes to life if you knew that everything would come back in the same way? And in the scholarship, this is typically focused on things like, well, that would mean the Holocaust returns. And who could say yes to the eternal repetition of life if it meant that the Holocaust came back as well? And that's, of course, a very legitimate question to ask because that's the power of the idea. It asks you, could you say yes to life if everything that you opposed also came back as well?
Did Nietzsche mean to take this idea of eternal recurrence literally, or is this more a metaphor?
Well, that's interesting because the book that I wrote tries to wrestle with that question because most scholars tend to think that even though in his notebooks he experimented with physics and certain scientific accounts of how it might be possible to show cyclic repetition through physical laws, nevertheless, he never published anything in that regard. And so many scholars say, well, he just didn't think he could pull it off, and he simply held that back. And so most scholars will read Eternal Recurrence as a kind of symbol for something, a symbol for life affirmation, let's say, or a symbol for time, or a symbol for struggle in general. And the idea there is that people tend to think, well, he couldn't have meant it literally. I mean, that's just too strange. And the fact that he gave up the idea of a scientific account of it makes them think that, well, he couldn't have meant it literally, and so it's our job to try to decode the idea. But I became convinced that in one sense he did mean it literally. He did mean this idea to be presented in just the way that it says. And it's really quite a simple idea, is that everything returns in the exact same way. What it means and why he did it is the complicated thing. And I try to wrestle with this by saying, well, he may not have meant it as a scientific fact, but I think he really meant us to take it literally. Because if you were going to think of it as just a symbol for something else, then you miss the force of the idea, because the force of the idea makes you have to think literally of things that have happened to your life, right? So that you could really confront the power of the idea. So I try to argue that he may not have meant it as a fact, scientifically, let's say, but rather, but he did mean it to be taken in just the way that he said it. Now, that doesn't take any of the strangeness away. In fact, it makes it even worse, because why would someone as brilliant as Nietzsche, or why would anyone come up with this idea that life just keeps coming back in the exact same way?
But you're saying,
but of course, the Stoics had that same idea. In the post-classical period, the Stoics had a similar idea about exact repetition.
Now, it would seem that this is kind of a quirky idea of Nietzsche's. I mean, okay, yeah. Kind of interesting, but, you know, let's move on to something more serious. But it sounds like you're saying this is actually one of his profound ideas, and actually quite central to his overall philosophy.
Well, I'm convinced of that. I think it is central to his philosophy. Whether or not one accepts it is another question, of course. But for him, and this is the interesting thing for a Nietzsche scholar, because he's such a brilliant thinker, then one thinks, wow, why would he have thought so intently on this idea when it does seem so strange? But in my reading, Nietzsche's philosophy really is built around the whole question of how can one confront life as it is, which has all the tragedy that life has, because none of us escapes alive. How can one confront life as it is, with all of its good and bad things together, in a way that could give a yes answer to the question of, do you affirm life? And I believe he thought Eternal Recurrence was the most powerful test that could bring that question out, because it sort of forces you to look at your life just the way it is and ask yourself, well, if that's all there is, am I satisfied? Do I feel cheated? And so on. So it does fit his general philosophy, because it really is a philosophy about coming to terms with life without having any otherworldly ideas, or even the idea of progress in the future that would fix everything.
Just to make that point clearer, I mean, Nietzsche is, of course, the philosopher who famously declared that God is dead. And, I mean, he was reacting against the whole idea of the afterlife, that, well, things will get better later on, you know, once we've departed from this earth. And so this is a very humanistic philosophy, and trying to find affirmation in what might seem to be kind of a nihilistic perspective.
Well, in fact, when he talked about the death of God, he meant that, well, you know, theology is no longer the center of thinking. It's still, people still believe in God, but it's no longer the requirement, the intellectual requirement. And so if God is now withdrawn from having the prominence that it had in previous ages, then the question is, well, what's left? And many modern thinkers say, well, we can replace God with secular notions that would do just as well, if not better. But Nietzsche actually took the existence of God very seriously, because he said this was an idea that was as powerful a thought as there was in the West. And in fact, the idea of God in Western thought was so productive of so many other things, including political ideas, scientific ideas, because all the great thinkers up to a certain point did still have a theology as part of their thinking. So he thought if God really is out of the picture, then pretty much everything sort of falls apart. And then the question is, well, what are we left with? And one of the possibilities would be, just as you said, we'd be left with nihilism. We'd be left with something that doesn't mean anything. And sometimes Nietzsche is taken to be a nihilist, but really he sees nihilism as a genuine possibility that has to be confronted, but his hope was always that one could overcome nihilism and have an affirmative posture towards life. And again, eternal recurrence becomes the test to see if that is possible.
But it's interesting, he's also rejecting the idea of progress, because there are those other famous secular thinkers, of Karl Marx being an obvious case, who, you know, who thought that things would keep getting better and better for humankind, that, you know, we could improve the social conditions and, you know, there would be better societies in the future. And Nietzsche's really throwing all that out.
Well, and as I said, that's how seriously he took the idea of God as this final consummated truth, because he said even though theology may have withdrawn, many secular doctrines simply transferred this idea of putting all things together into worldly terms. And so without believing in God, one might believe in a utopia. One might believe in the final solution of social problems in a communist society, or other kinds of ideas. There was a great belief in the progress of technology, that it would make life better and better. Nietzsche seems to lump all these ideas together, whether it's religion or progress or optimism for the future, as being wishful thinking. Not that he denies that there can be good things, but that the idea that all of existence could somehow wrap up into a solved package, that he rejected as a kind of a flight from reality. So he always wanted to force us to face the tragedy of things, and he thought the tragedy was the truth. And certainly eternal recurrence taps into that, because if one thinks that not only does my life come to an end, but I have to go through it again and again and again, including all, in my book, I mentioned that, well, for me, one of the hardest things to accept would be high school all over again. The thought of going through high school, it just fills me with terror.
Lawrence Attab is the author of Nietzsche's Life Sentence, Coming to Terms with Eternal Recurrence. He spoke with Steve Paulson. The Alfred Hitchcock film Vertigo was originally released in 1958, 50 years ago. It received mixed reviews, but is now considered to be a masterpiece. Many critics consider it one of the greatest movies ever made. Kim Novak stars in the film with James Stewart. Novak once said that there's a strange déjà vu with Vertigo, felt not just by the people in it, but the people who see it. Wendy Lesser can probably relate. She's an art critic, novelist, and editor, and the founding editor of the arts journal The Three Penny Review. She's seen Vertigo 8 or 9 times over the years, and she's written an essay about her viewings and reviewings of Vertigo. It's called Hitchcock's Vertigo. The essay appears in her book Nothing Remains the Same, Rereading and Remembering. Wendy Lesser read a few excerpts from her essay on Vertigo for us.
I can still, nearly 25 years later, recall in detail the powerful impact of that second viewing. I wasn't expecting it, since my response the first time had been mainly cerebral, but this time I was swept away by feeling. I am tempted to say it was as if I had never seen the movie before, but that is exactly not what it was. I was aware, even at the time, that what I was getting was the benefit of a second viewing. The first time I was too caught up in the suspense, and if that is your primary motive, the end of Vertigo can be a bit disappointing. But once you know how it ends, you are freed to focus on the emotional progression of the film. For the first time, I saw how much the movie was about loss and about second chances, both subjects that I newly and deeply cared about at the age of 24. What had seemed melodramatic and hokey to me before now seemed tragic and true. This was what love was like, I thought, and nothing other than Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra had shown it to me so clearly. Was it I thought I was learning about love from Vertigo? No, that condescending tone is unfair. I was learning, or at the very least confirming what I had begun to suspect. Well, all the usual things that people who have ever had their hearts even mildly broken, almost all of us, that is, have taken from this movie over the years. That you temporarily lose yourself when you lose somebody you love. Not necessarily to death. A simple breakup will do. That, in the effort to recover what you have lost, you go vainly back to the places you have visited with the beloved, looking as much for your former self as for your missing other half. that your next attempt at love will have in it a much greater measure of will. Having been tricked by chance, or luck, or fate, you are less able to relax into its hands the next time around. That, despite this excess of will, your next love affair will follow roughly the same pattern as your last one, because you have not really lost yourself. Your essential character is all too much with you still, preventing you from being other than you have always been. That lovers are selfish and demanding. They wish to remake the beloved in the image of their own desire, and any deviation from that ideal will irk them. That the person you think you love may not be that person at all. That it is easier to be in love with fictional characters, or dreams, or visions, or images, than it is with real, down-to-earth people. That love is mysterious and archaic, with something almost ghostly about it, so that being powerfully in love seems to take you back to some point of origin, back beyond your childhood, to a past you couldn't actually have known. We are soulmates. I seem to have known him forever. These are the banal, colloquial expressions of a feeling that Vertigo, with all its dramatic excess, subtly and skillfully captures. I have seen the movie 4 or 5 times since then, and no viewing has been quite so overwhelming as that second one. Vertigo is, after all, about second chances and second chances only. There is magic in that number, too. But I have never seen it without noticing or feeling something new. It is a movie that never goes dead on me, though granted, I have made sure not to see it too frequently, not to let it fade into an annual cliché like It's a Wonderful Life or Peter Pan. With the exception of one videotape viewing when I was writing about Vertigo in the late 1980s for my second book, I have let the movie come to me on its own schedule, as it did when I first saw it. This most recent time, it happened to be on television, in a beautifully reconstructed print, on a channel with no commercials. My husband noticed it in the daily listings as he was casting about for something for us to watch on TV, and read it out almost jokingly, as if assuming we couldn't possibly watch that again, because we had just seen it together a few years earlier, and before that each of us had seen it many times on our own. The last time we'd seen it, the newly restored print was playing at the Castro Theater in San Francisco, which is one of the few perfectly maintained movie palaces from cinema's glamorous era, a place where it is always a pleasure to see an old film, especially an old film about San Francisco. That time we had taken our son, as part of what we felt was his necessary education. He has since become a cinephile of excessive proportions, as perhaps only adolescents can be, and this time he was out at a movie himself, possibly even his second movie of the day, while we were at home watching Vertigo on TV. All this was in my mind as I sat down to watch it. I was aware, that is, of the way in which the movie marked off certain milestones in my life, so that I was one kind of wife and mother the last time I saw it, a different kind, a later, older kind, this time. And of course, I had not been a wife or a mother at all the first time I saw it, or the second, or even the third. The fear of repetition and the lure of repetition. These are the two poles between which the movie vibrates. Scotty is a man who is doomed to repeat himself, even verbally, it seems. I look up, I look down. I look up, I look down, he says, as he is practicing on Midge's stepladder. Or, you're my second chance, Judy, you're my second chance. Randall Jarrell said of the husband in Robert Frost's Home Burial that, quote, if one knew only this man, one would say, man is the animal that repeats, unquote. But in Vertigo, it's not just the one man. The symptom is contagious. Midge, too, begins to repeat. Stupid, 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 she accuses herself as she destroys the grotesque portrait that has angered Scotty. The verbal tick is not just a tick. It is symptomatic of the way people in this movie live their lives. But then, no detail in a Hitchcock movie is just a tick. The pieces all fit together as a perfect, seamless whole, with each element contributing its bit toward the larger picture. Unlike other thriller directors, Hitchcock does not make mistakes. If you go back over the movie once the disguises and tricks have been ripped away, you won't find any unexplained, inexplicable plot elements, any useless or dishonest red herrings. My own ghost in relation to this movie, my own Carlotta, if you will, is San Francisco. Watching Vertigo this time, I felt more strongly than anything else a pang for that lost city of my youth. Those shots of the city as a whole, in which Coit Tower was the tallest structure on the horizon, that was the San Francisco of my childhood. And even in the days when I first knew the man who is now my husband, and we claimed the entire city as our pleasure haunt and place of refuge, San Francisco was more like its old self than its new one. More like the vision in Hitchcock's movie than the traffic-filled, skyscraper-shaded place it is now. Like Scotty, I am mourning a beloved who never really existed. San Francisco was certainly very beautiful. It still is, compared with most places. But it was never exactly like the city in Vertigo. I don't just mean that Hitchcock has played fast and loose with the street patterns and the views out windows, though he has notoriously done that. I don't even mean that he has made the colors richer and the streets cleaner, and the parking easier than they ever were in real life. All movies do that sort of thing. I guess I mean that the San Francisco whose loss I now feel so intensely is not the one I actually walked and drove around in, but the one I came to know and remember through my successive viewings of Vertigo.
Wendy Lesser, reading excerpts from her essay Hitchcock's Vertigo. The essay is from Lesser's book Nothing Remains the Same, Rereading and Remembering. Do you have a favorite movie that you like to watch over and over again? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, a novel in which a psychiatrist becomes convinced that his wife is not really his wife at all, as we conclude our hour on déjà vu. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Rivka Gulchin received her M.D. from Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Then she completed her M.F.A. at Columbia. Now, Gulchin has written her first novel. It's called Atmospheric Disturbances. It's been described as Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, as directed by the screenwriter Charlie Kaufman. From the audiobook version of Atmospheric Disturbances, here's Malcolm Hilgartner reading an excerpt from the opening pages.
Last December, a woman entered my apartment who looked exactly like my wife. This woman casually closed the door behind her. In an oversized pale blue purse, Rima's purse, she was carrying a russet puppy. I did not know the puppy. And the real Rima, She doesn't greet dogs on the sidewalk. She doesn't like dogs at all. The hay feverishly fresh scent of Remus shampoo was filling the air, and through that brashness, I squinted at this woman and at that small dog, acknowledging to myself only that something was extraordinarily wrong. She, the woman, the possible dog lover, leaned down to Dishu. Her hair obscured her face somewhat, and my migraine occluded the edges of my vision, but still I could see. Same unzipping of wrinkly boots, same taking off of same baby blue coat with jumbo charcoal buttons, same tucking behind ears of dyed corn silk blonde hair, same bangs cut straight across, like on those dolls done up in native costumes that live their whole lives in plastic cases held up by a metal wire around the waist. Same everything. But it wasn't Rima. It was just a feeling, that's how I knew. Like the moment near the end of a dream, when I am sometimes able to whisper to myself, I am dreaming. I remember once waking up from a dream in which my mother, dead now for 33 years, was sipping tea at my kitchen table, reading a newspaper on the back of which there was a headline, Wrong Man, Right Name, Convicted in Murder Trial. I was trying to read the smaller print of the article, but my mother kept moving the paper, readjusting, turning pages, a sound like a mess of pigeons taking sudden flight. When I woke up, I searched all through the house for that newspaper and through the trash outside as well, but I never found it. Oh, the simulacrum said quietly, seeming to notice the dimmed lights. I'm so sorry. She imitated Rima's Argentine accent perfectly, the halos around the vowels. You are having your migraine? She pressed that lean russet puppy against her chest. The puppy trembled. I held a hushing finger to my lips, maybe hamming up my physical suffering, but also signing truly, because I was terrified, though of precisely what I could not yet say.
Malcolm Hilgartner reading an excerpt from the audiobook version of Rivka Gulchin's debut novel, Atmospheric Disturbances. Gulchin explained the premise of her book.
Well, basically, Leo, he's a 51-year-old psychiatrist. He's somewhat distant, somewhat cold, a little bit eccentric, but basically a normal guy. He has a wife who's significantly younger than him and who's also not from the same country. She's Argentine. So it's a marriage that maybe has a little bit more mystery in it than most. And one day he just develops this conviction that it's not her anymore, and he has to attempt to solve the mystery of what happened, but more importantly, to recover his wife, who's basically disappeared.
He is looking for the woman he loves.
Exactly. Yeah. Aren't we all?
Yes. In his case, his passion to find her is every bit as strong as any romantic hero's could be, but the reader is always aware that she's there.
Right, and that tension is important to me because there's a sense in which Leo can come off as incredibly cruel and cold, which in some ways his actions often are cruel towards the woman who is living in his apartment and chasing him down when he sets off in search of quote-unquote her. And yet at the same time, it would be wrong to not understand it as a kind of beautiful romance at the same time.
In his case, it's almost like a case of déjà vu because he's remembering. It gets confusing at this point, doesn't it? He's remembering the real Rima while living with the, to him, new Rima. But it is for him almost as though the same thing is happening again, but in a different time frame.
Right, right. And I just sort of think, one quote-unquote mistake that Leo makes is he's sort of uncomfortable with kind of the dynamic, with change at all, with any sort of movement through time. He's sort of stuck in certain moments and certain times. But then also there's a sense that, you do have a incomplete and uncorrect impressionist. I like those 1930s sort of comedies of remarriage, those 30s and 40s things where, some couple gets together on the wrong premise. Like, he thinks she's like an heiress and really she's a card shark. And so they fall in love and then they have to break up when the truth comes out. And then they have to figure out some way to get back together based on who they quote unquote really are.
And in some ways, that's what Leo's trying to do, although in his case, he had her. He had everything. And, well, that's the whole point of the story, isn't it?
Oh, no, yeah, yeah. So that, I mean, I just sort of like the idea that, like, he seems to have a sort of outsized fear of losing her, and he manages to preempt it by kind of losing her deliberately so that it can't sort of sneak up on him by surprise. He's sort of like, you know, the classic neurotic thing where you sort of arrive at the point from which you seem to be running from all the time.
One of the things we haven't talked about that's essential to understand, and it comes up in the title of the book, is that you've worked meteorology into the novel as well. And I suppose in some ways you've done the same thing with that science that you've done with his psychosis. It isn't quite meteorology the way the scientists view it, is it?
Right, exactly. It's sort of, you know, a particular language, a particular set of words and way of talking about motion and change that he can project a lot of emotion into. So he sort of will hear something about shifts in Doppler, and he'll sort of have his own sort of emotional read of that.
There's a lovely turn of phrase that you use, the Doppler ganger.
Yeah, he's a bit of a neologian, Leo. But yeah, that's sort of his moment of appropriating the scientific terminology so that it fits into his emotional landscape.
Is that what you've done, too? You've taken a scientific vocabulary and your scientific training and adopted them in your literary persona?
I guess so. I mean, I think that there's a lot of misdirected emotion in the novel. I mean, the part of what's being shown is how, you know, supposedly Leo misses his wife, but he pours all his energy into this rather eccentric project that's only distancing her. And at the same time, I feel like I, you know, sort of have like maybe a lot of emotion invested in the character of the meteorologist Svigal Chen that has my father's name, but I've sort of stolen all of that and, you know, misdirected that emotion towards these characters. And that language is kind of like the passage through which that's happening, the passage through which an emotion in one setting is kind of being transformed.
Well, I have to ask about that. It is not common to stick your father into a story, at least using his own name, and here you did. Obviously a conscious decision, but why?
Well, you know, when you're writing your first novel, it's very lonely, so you just got to keep yourself entertained. It was just a real pleasure just to, you know, as like a personal joke, like a family joke, to put his name in there, and that was kind of a pleasure, and that was probably the main thing that was going on, because it's not his real character that comes through. A lot of emotion is projected onto him. He becomes a kind of mock hero in the novel, but it's not him.
Yeah. Well, it's worth pointing out that your father passed away some years ago, and this, I guess, in some ways was a way of bringing part of him back.
Right. I mean, I always find that somehow embarrassing but true. Like, of course, you can't bring someone back, but you can. It's kind of like an exercise. They, you know, during the process of writing the book, like, he came to my mind much more vividly. So, you know, a lot of memories I'd forgotten about would come just through the sort of like incantatory process of saying his name.
Was there any disorientation, kind of like Leo's, when you had your father on the page, or this part of your father? Because it's a simulacrum in some ways. It's not your father, but it has many of his gestures and thoughts and ways of presenting himself in the world.
Yeah, it was sort of odd and fun to have him transmuted, because I have his language in the book as well. I quote from his scientific papers. And so there was that kind of dizzying sense of the space between what he was becoming in the book and, you know, my own sort of ghost of him that I had around.
We talked a little earlier about the Doppler effect and the use you made of it, the Doppler ganger effect, but I didn't ask you where that came from. Can you tell me about what you mean when you talk about the Doppler ganger effect?
He's just sort of merging. Leo comes up with that when he's sort of merging two concepts. Like, first of all, you know, this doppelganger has arrived in his home, this lookalike of his wife. You know, there's, you know, all sorts of possible interpretations of that. He's not sure what to go with. But then he kind of stumbles through kind of pursuit accident. He stumbles across some Doppler radar meteorologic research, which he feels is relevant to the mystery of his wife. And because Doppler effect is about trying to sort of understand what's really going on based on our distorted perception of what's going on, and the distortion happens because things are moving in the process of looking at them, he's saying, well, maybe I can look at my situation and the perceived delta of my wife, the perceived change in my wife, and the perceived change in my own state. Maybe I can, like, account for the possibility that I'm seeing things incorrectly by using the same logic of the Doppler effect. And that the same thing, you could sort of switch perspectives from the outside and look at it for him. So he's like, so that's kind of the situation I'm in. Like, you know, my life is the Doppelganger effect. So it kind of mixes those two words. Kind of, you know, it's such a silly word. And yet he says it fairly seriously just because he's in such an odd situation that things that would normally be goofy, he takes serious.
This is the real Leo, isn't it? He's such an extraordinary, intelligent man and able to use so disparate an array of information to almost accurately look at the world. He's even aware that it's only almost accurate, but he can't quite make that last twist to see the reality.
And I really like the sort of sound and cadence of covering up whatever it is we don't want to see. Like, I just like the kind of rhythm of someone using analytic thought not to kind of penetrate something but to obscure something. And I think that that's what he's really talented at.
Rivka Galchin is the author of Atmospheric Disturbances. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 97A, Deja Vu All Over Again. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
It's a phenomenon known as déjà vu. You arrive at a place you've never been. But it feels familiar.
Do you ever have deja vu, Mrs. Lancaster?
I don't think so, but I could check with the kitchen.
Deja vu.
There is something so familiar about this.
Hmm?
Do you ever have deja vu?
Didn't you just ask me that?
Deja vu. If you think it's just a feeling, go back and look again.
PRI, Public Radio International.